Today is Tuesday, June 27th, 2023. This is part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imsland. Scott spells his last name I-M-S-L-A-N-D. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. Yeah, it's a pleasant day out here on the coast, so it's really nice to be outside having this interview with you. We wanted to start up this session kind of where we ended off on the last session, which was Jeff Ahrens and I scrambling and making our way out of the Grand Canyon in Are you still there?
I am. And you know what, Scott, before we get going, you're exactly right where we're going to land this interview. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yeah, that's great. I probably have a phone call coming in that's what's happening. I'm not going to answer it.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, 1983. Yeah. Can you pick that thread up after you returned from your hike down to the North Bass area with Jeff Aronson?
Yeah. So, yeah, we got out of that hike, and I'm here to describe what happened once I returned to the warehouse where all the gear was and where all the people were meeting to start up another river season. And nobody at that period of time in 1983, probably, you know, early June or somewhere in that period when everybody got together and the trip started to go out, we on our hike hadn't realized that there was so much snowpack and there was so much heat that all that was coming down into Glen Canyon was coming down into the Grand on the Colorado, and nobody really picked up on it. Even on our hike, it wasn't like, well, that was an oddity that we hiked through with a flooding Shinumu Creek. But no, we should have understood that Powell was filling up with water. Glen Canyon Dam was getting threatened with too much water. And we have all these river companies that are having all these book trips to go down the Grand Canyon, you know, finally, and off we go. And at the various talks that we had at the warehouse of what trips were going out, and I don't recollect any time at that beginning that the management or us from our hike and that flooding had any idea that the Colorado was going to go up into the volumes of flow from the dam that actually was right on its way. We were in the heart of it, and nobody from Park Service to the owners of our company, Azra, was aware, you know, what is there anything we should be worried about, you know, or blah, 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 you know, looks like the dam's getting pretty high. Nobody really thought like, oh, the dam could break. Oh, they're letting out so much water. That's going to affect all the campsites downstream. It's going to affect all the rapids downstream. It's going to take out, going to get affected. Everything was going to get affected by what was happening, which was North Rim. It was all warm, standard Grand Canyon heat. All that snow was bleeding off into rain down all the side canyons. And then it was filling up Lake Powell so high that the dam had to put plywood, which I went up to look at, and I couldn't believe that really. What, we're protecting everybody downstream with a bunch of plywood stuck up there so the dam could take on more water that was coming than it couldn't control? The amount of water coming in, so they put plywood up so it wouldn't like go over the top of the dam, and so that's kind of the framework that we all who didn't understand what was going on really all of a sudden it was going to be an issue. In fact, I had a meeting with guides and the Azra management, you know. What do you think? Should we run this trip? And we didn't know. Nobody had been down yet to see what was down there. And I said I will guide the first trip down, and we'll get a feel for what's going on. And then I can let you know if we make it off. I'll let you know what I thought of it. And if I don't, we'll stop at minimum. We'll stop at Phantom and walk everybody out or whatever. And so what turned out is that I don't remember exactly probably what the flow was at that time that we ran our first Ezra trip with people. But it was probably, you know, we were used to the highs of maybe 30 to 35,000, 3,500. And the water was bigger than that, but not scary bigger or anything yet. But it was big. It was coming up, and that didn't stop the put in. And we all headed on down, and it started like everything from Lee's Ferry through everything until we got into the 20s. And when the 20s hit, and I had heard, you know, early in my time in Grand Canyon, old timers, guys that had been around a lot, I don't know why this would even come up, but they said they had been there in ancient times pretty much. And they said the 20s are really bad. When you hit the 20s at big water, the 20s were difficult. And so I never forgot that. And we got down into the 24 and a half mile and 25 mile and Tiger Wash in that area there. That's when we made a camp on the left side at either 24 and a half or 25 mile. And pulling in, it was beginning to get like the river was just a racetrack of power, of speed. It was, everything was just different. It was so, It wasn't, at this point, it wasn't that the rapids did anything until we got to the 20s. And then the 20s, luckily, it was kind of an eye-opener for me and the other few boats that were with me. And pulling into a camp on the left side at 24 and a half or so, something like that, that's the only place that hadn't gotten the water up so high yet. That was a place that was chosen. And pulling in and getting your boats to stop with all that kind of speed, and that was very tricky. Pulling boats in when it was wall-to-wall, fast-moving water, and no eddies, just kind of like climb into and go around and peel off into a campsite. It was so fast and so difficult to stop the boats that you had to be an artist in just figuring out how you were going to dive into the top of this eddy, and if somebody was in before you, they could catch a stern line to hold you to shore. All that kind of stuff. But that was going on in the 20s. And luckily, when we got through that, I remember getting stuck in an eddy. Eddies were bad. That was the crucial thing, was the eddies, whirlpools, boils, all that stuff. But at Tiger Wash, I got stuck in an eddy there. And I'm for this amount of water, I was out gunned. I had a Avon Pro, and the other people had a little bit bigger, like 10-man, typical modern 6-8, 10-man rafts rowing them. But I had a tiny boat, and
like a 14-footer or 16-footer?
Maybe 16.
Okay.
But the tube size wasn't very big.
Okay.
But the tube side, you know, everything about it felt like I was outgunned. I was like, I'm almost at water level here. I mean, this is crazy. And at this point, still, you know, we don't have a clue, really, other than the water has gotten higher and it's gotten faster. And at that point, nobody, you know, was just like, well, we're not even down this thing, and we're seeing some changes, significant changes. Should we even be down here? Or, you know, was that a big mistake to put in? Those are kind of some of the thoughts as it got bigger. And I was really happy that I think it was Jim Hall on a motor rig. I don't know if it was Tour West or who it was. I don't remember what Jim was a part of. It wasn't Western, it was something else. And it might have been Hatch. But anyway, they understood we couldn't catch it. We went the speed of the water, and the motor rigs were motoring, you know, down through things. And thank God, he went through those 20s, and he had the smarts, knowing that we were behind him a little bit, that he pivoted around and waited for us to get through the 20s, because it opened his eyes like, wow, this is really, dramatic water right now. And it was really comforting to have that motor rig sitting at the bottom. And he stood with us, kept with us, probably through Soap Creek and down into Redwall, somewhere from that. He shadowed us. And that was really nice. And it gave some comfort. But on the left-hand side, when I got into that eddy at Tiger Wash, that's when the swirling, boiling water and the ferocity of it slamming the walls on the left side and the boils coming up, and I could just see my little boat just getting stuck in that and being sucked down against a wall with fast-moving water going at me and going away from me. It was like, that's going to be the art. That's going to be getting down, is dealing with these eddies with all these currents that are bashing into each other. It's bouncing off the bottom of the river. It's slamming into walls, coming back out. And that was the big eye-opener. When I saw something, I go, man, I don't want to have anything to do with that wall. And that was just the beginning of the eye-opening. And so we got past all that, and we ran on down. And I think our next campsite, I think it was sort of in the Tanner area. And we're also now also thinking about campsites. And we're going, gosh, where are we going to camp with this kind of water coming up? And you got to think ahead as to, like, wow, you know, where can we camp? Will Olo be there? Will this campsite be there? Gosh, I don't think there'll be campsites there. We're running out of campsites because the water's so high. And I think we made a stop at Tanner or Cardenas or something like that up on the left side, and we were able to do another camp there. But at that time, I've talked to a few friends about this now. Helicopters, we could see that helicopters were coming down canyon periodically, or why are they here? They shouldn't be. What's going on? Why helicopters in the Grand Canyon right now? This is unheard of. And what it was is they were dropping messages down to the people that were on the river at the time to give them heads up that the dam, Glen Canyon Dam, was now holding back, you know, X footage, and it was getting close to the top of the dam. This is the flow coming out. And what happened to us is that we were, through one of the notes, we were to take the trip down to Phantom, where we would unload all of our people, and they would hike out with Ezra would have brought somebody to help them out and get their gear out, maybe even helicoptered them, I don't remember. But at that time, we were getting messages as to what the flow was, and then you should get to Phantom, and that's going to be it for the passengers.
Go to Phantom and hike out.
And hike out. Fly or hike out. I'm not sure what they did. But so that was, here we are. We're down with what I've talked about. And this goes back to the very, very beginnings where we didn't understand at the time what a flooding Colorado was going to be like, and the dam and everything and campsites. If we would have known that, which was a part of why I guess my trip was sent down to find out what's going on down there. But it's kind of, you know, it's kind of blind, the height of the water at Lake Powell and all this. We're kind of like the heads up, you know, but hell, we'd never been through any kind of water. I'd done it, like we have talked earlier, in Idaho on the Selway in the Middle Fork, you know. We went out in the floods no matter what, and it wasn't quite like that with Ezra and this trip is exploratory down, but it kind of turned into that because it was so much volume and so much speed that it was like at a different level. And so far, we had no accidents, nothing happened, but then we got the notes that with the Park Service and with somebody from Ezra was in the plane probably too, and they dropped the messages to get the trip down to Phantom, and we'll get rid of the passengers, and we're going to take on a whole extra crew to help on each of the boats, because these were not self-bailing boats. They would fill up with water. And so we got a whole group of guides from Ezra to hike down and join us. And I gave them...
So hang on. Hang on, Scott. Let me make sure I understand this. So the concept was at Phantom, passengers were going to evacuate.
Yeah.
But the crew would double so that there was someone to bail and someone to row.
Exactly.
Got it. Okay.
And, you know, to like pull spare oars when the oars snapped or were lost in a hole or whatever. And
sure.
Any kind of help a second person could be. And going back to the Selway and Middle Fork floods, is that's what was crucial, was to have a whole extra group of guides on the boats so that you had capable people supporting one another, knowing what to do, where danger was, what was going on, how to handle it. And that's okay. What we did in Grand Canyon. And we just put a whole new crew, a whole extra crew on. And I had a meeting, I guess, with all the new people, and this is what we've gone through, and this is our take on what's happening. Watch out for the eddy lines, getting stuck in eddies. There's a lot of turbulence out there. Even if the rapids are getting washed out, there's walls to deal with, and so I just kind of try to give everybody a heads up on what they're getting into having. They don't know anything.
Right.
You know, they were like us starting. And so they had to come up to speed for what we'd already gone through with our eye-opening experiences.
Okay.
But nothing threatened a flip of a boat yet. And so we got everybody picked for the various boats to go on. And we headed out. And we had plenty of food because we had food and all of the gear. We had everything for a full commercial trip. So we gained all these guys and gals and headed on down.
Did any of the passengers say, no, I'm not leaving, I'm going to keep going? You guys are keeping going, I'm keeping going?
No, there's nobody did that.
Okay.
I mean, it was eye-opening, and probably the posture of the guides that were on that part of the trip and the discussions that we were having around campfires and stuff, going, wow, you know, what a day this was, you know. And then all of a sudden to have a helicopter drop information about what we're supposed to do, get out at Phantom, and that kind of, you know, was icing on the cake. Like, yeah, somebody else thinks this is pretty intense too, apparently. And I think Grand Canyon Park was, I don't know if they had shut down yet by this time. We were on the water, so I don't know, but maybe the note was, you know, we're going to stop all river trips down here, you know, get off at Phantom and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, we got to Phantom, got everybody loaded up, gave them heads up, and we just headed on down. And like I mentioned, the rapids, Horn Creek and Granite and all Zoc and all that stuff, those were all underwater, so they were never an issue. And so we eventually got down to Crystal. And this is all happens very quickly. Boom, 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 you're down. Oh, God, where do you think we're at now? Everything's full of water, wall-to-wall water. You know, God, where do you think, where are we now? Oh, I think we just, you know, this and that. We just went by that. And so our next spot to stop was, and I think you've produced on a Grand Canyon River Guides a picture of some old-timers that pulled in across from Bass Camp and had moored there either for a campsite. It's not much of a campsite, but I remember you posting something one time, and I had a response that that's exactly where at high water the Ezra trip pulled into camp, because that was the only place that had a place to pull in, and that we could anchor against a wall there, and then we would eat off the boats, but at least we were stopped, and in case the dam broke. Now the kind of the comical fear is that, wow, we're down here in the Grand Canyon, and that dam might break. We got to pick a place. It's hard to find a place to camp because all the water is up so high that, wow, we're getting notes about how high the water is and what the dam's doing and everything. I go, God, really, what if the dam broke and we're down here? And it was kind of like half jest, half serious, and then more and more serious. As all these campsites further down were just non-existent. Olo, you could have rowed up Olo, and then you can row into Deer Creek. You could row into Redwall Cavern, all this kind of stuff. So I decided that, you know, looking downstream in my mind, we've got to pull over and eat, spend the night, get rested before we head on down, which will be crystal and lava, and eventually we'll get down to Diamond Creek in another day or two. We're going so fast, you can make all this time like nothing. So we pulled in to that camp, which isn't really a camp. It's just a steep gravel rock hillside that goes up. But there was enough spots to kind of do the kitchen and sleep on the boats. And if the dam did break, they would probably send helicopters down to say the dam broke, you know. And then that would have given us a whole mountainside to climb up. I don't know if you could climb up, 900 yards, 1,000 yards up high. I don't know what it would take, but at least we weren't on the water's level at that time. So if the dam went, I was just thinking we need to have some exit. And the only exit that I see or think of is the spot across from Bass Camp. So anyway, we spent the night there. And from there, it was quick down. No big issues. I don't think, I know somebody flipped in Hermit one time, but I'm not sure that flip was on this particular trip, preliminary high water trip. I think the water was now at this point up to 60,000, and when we finished the trip, it was at 75,000, something like that. So we packed up, left that Bass Camp, and we headed on down, saw what we saw, and got down to Crystal, of which we pulled in way upstream of it. That was the other thing. If you wanted to get someplace specifically, you had to plan quite a ways upstream, whether that meant bumping off of rocks to stop your speed or finding a temporary eddy before you got spun back out. It was just the amount of volume and the speed of everything and how high it was going on all the walls. But we headed on down to Crystal, and we pulled in to Crystal. And at this point, we had no idea, no information from anybody before us, because nobody was before us. We were seeing and going, wow, that's a heads up we got to give everybody. If they keep running this thing, even if it goes down to 50,000, they might start running, but it's still a problem. It's still big water. So we got down to Crystal, and we were able to pull over kind of upstream and and go on down and watch Crystal. And there were other Wilderness World was there, and I don't think at that second week, I don't recollect getting to watch, but I'm sure there were motor rigs go through. But we sat there and looked at it, and it was all full of water. Of course, the hole was big. The rock garden was way underwater, so that wasn't an issue. But the only run that we could figure was to actually pretty much bump along the far right edge of the river in the rocks there and over some tamarisk, and just keep it as far out of even close to the idea of being in line with that hole. It was all, you know, bump along here, bump along here. Don't pop an oar because you're going to be doing this and that. Mm. If you lose oar power and you get sucked out, it's all over.
Right.
So it was, if you think of lava and crystal, it was always, you know, before it changed, and we talked about this earlier in the interviews and stuff, how we did run the hole just before, and it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
But now, it was just a massive hole and ugly and everything. And so going down the far right as far as you could, always defending against the center and keeping it right, worked out fine. And I do believe that Gary Bolton was there. If you know Gary Bolton,
No.
He wrote for Wilderness World, and he's worked for Kovalec over in Africa, all over the place.
Okay.
Similar age, and I had known him ever since. I think he came to some of the art of training stuff on the Stanislaus and met there. And we just always kind of like were in the same groups of guides and everything. But he'd been all over, farther than I had wanted to go. I'd been offered trips to Africa and Alaska and other places. But, you know, when I was done with my season, that was kind of it for me. Hmm. But Gary had done a lot of this stuff. So he was there looking at this, and he said, you know, all the time I spent in the Grand Canyon, I always wondered, you know, why this river doesn't have a rapid that we line our boats through. I mean, I've been in lots of rivers where we had to line to get through things.
Oh, uh-huh.
And this might be the time that there's finally a moment to line a boat around and bump it along the rocks and have somebody on the bow with a line and on the stern guiding it, you know, down through its best little channels. And I kind of half agreed. I said, yeah. But this is also after we've been looking at it for quite some time. And I go, you know, I can run this. I think if we just keep right on in the Tamarisk and bump along the boulders and stuff, it will be okay. And I said, I'll go down first and just see how it goes. And I do believe, just for kicks, somebody decided that they didn't really want to row it. And so he said, well, let's line your boat. You'll be the only person that I know of in the company that ever lined a boat at Crystal, and you probably picked a good time to do it. I mean, at least don't be ashamed of lining your boat down through here. It's fine. And so I went back, and I ran through, and it was fine. And unfortunately, not unfortunately, but I had left my movie camera, my old Bolex mechanical camera, with my friend. Actually, it was Bob Melville that had my camera, and I said, well, film me in case something happens. I want a film of what I did wrong or what was the outcome. Mm-hmm. So film me going through this thing. And he did that, but that left my camera with him upstream, and I had pulled into an eddy down below before Tuna. I had gotten to shore, and I'm sitting there watching, and I don't think I left the people off of my boat. We all stayed on the boat in case something weird happened and we had to get going or something emergency. Yeah. So we stayed with the boat, and I'm watching, and I see one Western rig come down, motor rig, and Western rigs are pretty broad. You know, they've got the snout kind of tubes, so they've got a bow to, like, cut through things. It's not a bad motor rig, but it's kind of like taking those rowing snout rigs we talked about and stacking, like, three or four of them side by side and putting floors in them and a transom in the back and go down river with 25 people on it. And so I'm sitting down there just below the hole up against in an eddy there. And I see the first Western rig come through, and I'm going, oh, my God, he's lined up. And I've got a great view of what's happening. I'm looking dead in the center, up the heart of everything. Hmm. And that motor rig went and hit like motor rigs do. They're God. He was dead center on the hole, and nobody, like I'm saying, had seen the Grand Canyon at these water levels yet. This was everybody's first view of what's happening in the Grand Canyon right now. No water was ever big enough for the oar rigs or motor rigs to have seen anything like we were seeing. And that motor rig lined up dead center on that hole, and he disappeared. He dropped in dead center, disappeared. And I'll never forget, like, the spray shooting up like a geyser through the gaps in the floor. When he hit that hole, it was just, it was fearsomely ugly to see how that big, huge boat got toyed with and how hard it got hit and how it stood up. And everybody stayed on. Luckily, they all hung on to the most ferocious impact I've seen a motor rig go through. And you could tell everybody on that boat was shocked. The guide on the boat was waving furiously to the guy behind him who was lining up in the same spot. And he's trying to, the guy above him on the Western rig, there's two Western rigs were together. So they were the trip. And the first one survived it, got hammered, and didn't lose any gear off the boat, and shot out of it. And the next guy down was getting waved at to, you know, move to the side, you know, don't go here, don't go here. All the best he can do with his arms, you know, don't go here, don't go here, because he's now run the hole and he's going downstream far away from his other boat. And he's waving, you know, don't. And the guy went dead center on it. And so I have a second shot dead underneath looking at him, and he hits that thing, and he went up on his tail. The whole Western rig did an endo with the stern of that boat attached to the river still, or base, not really. He was up in the air. So he hit that hole, and it shot him straight up in the air, straight up, a whole Western rig, straight up out of the hole. And it was just like, I'll never forget, it was just like it hovered in the air above that hole. It hit so hard, and on the mammoth drop to disappear it made, then to get shot out and up the next wall with the rooster tail at the top, that he was up in the air, stalled, and he fell straight back over, upside down, with everybody, all the gear. It was like if I had my movie camera, I would have been a millionaire for selling that footage of what happened. And it was so incredible. It was like I've never seen anything as horrible and fascinating as this. I mean, this is absolute train wreck right now. Two cranes going head and head, bang, and that boat stood up, and then to watch it slowly not go sideways, not do this or that. It went straight up, came back down on its stern, and then flipped right back on itself with all those people on it, and all the gear started to come loose, and the cargo lids were off, and there was stuff everywhere. People were washing down, and we're talking in floods of probably 60,000 right now, going down into Tuna, around President Nixon, down into the Jewels, down to the Bass, you know, this whole thing. And I didn't have any of my boats down, but Wilderness World, Dennis Silva did have some of his boats, and the motor rig below was doing salvage and collecting people. And the Wilderness World crew, I think they might have at this point gotten their boats down, and I didn't have any of my boats down yet other than I was below. But I was wondering, gosh, should I leave my group and go and chase people? Mm-hmm. And thank goodness the motor rig I could see was collecting people. And then Dennis's group peeled off and started to pick people up. And I think it took them quite some time to get everybody, maybe even down to the Jewels to grab everybody and whatever. But I stayed with my group, and luckily everybody did a good run, and there were no issues there. We collected ourselves at the bottom and headed back out in order to help. And I don't recollect that we were needed at that point, because I think the motor rig and the rowboats had done whatever was necessary. But I do remember, I think some of, and you may know this, the history, that nobody drowned, but people were in the water for a really long time. And when you went through, you know, in the next trips down, you're going, God, people swam through this thing. Mm. And they swam around the corner at Tuna and through the next Jules Rapids. And my God, terrible. How did they not drown?
Yeah.
And so anyway, that was Crystal. That's the story of Crystal and the Western rig. And so at that point, trying to think of where we camped after that.
So do you think, I mean, let's just talk about this for a minute. Do you think that the motor guys were basically running their standard run?
Oh, totally.
And weren't thinking about, hey, we can cheat this on the right.
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. And that's where, like, you had a motor rig, I think it was a Tour West, somebody flipped in a Nanqueweep Rapid, which is nothing. I mean, we went through Nanqueweep and there wasn't anything. But I got up the river, either from this trip or the next one or whatever. They said, you wouldn't believe it, but so-and-so, Tour West or whatever, flipped in Nanqueweep on the right-hand kind of turn where it swings around, and there's a camp there, and then it's rock shoals on the right side. But, yeah, so the motor rigs, really proved, other than Jim Hall, like I said, that saw danger and supported us until we got into clear water, you know, up in the 20s and below. He would have known. Older guides would have known, because just, you know, were to talk with the historians that have been down there forever or whatever, and there's always going to be a story about this and that, and watch out for this, which is how I learned just a little bit of that kind of information. But that those guides, I know a number of boats flipped in Crystal when I got to see the Western flip, and there were some clunky commercial trips down there, and I think every one of those kind of clunky ones flipped there, because these guys aren't river runners. They're Grand Canyon, you know, point the thing and this is your run, you know.
Right.
Forever. This is right. How you do. Got it? Okay. Take that boat of people, 35 people out, just hit them straight, you know, and watch out for that. Okay, go. You know, and that's what it's all that period of time felt like. Because I walked up, Lorna and I hiked to Slate Creek overlook there, for fun, to see, like, you know, we're off, we've done our trip, and we're going to go enjoy watching boats eat it in Crystal. So, and you could. You go down Hermit Trail or whatever it is to get down to Slate Creek. And then we just camped there and watched boats come down and go, oh, my God, they're going to hit that thing sideways. I can't believe it. You know, and just how goofy these people were, the guides running these boats. And so we sat there and watched up, and this is we're finally off the river, of course, right now. But anyway, getting us off the river, we all we thought about, I think we went down to National. I think we left there and went and camped at National. We were amazed how much water was up in that Catamiba and Olo and Deer Creek. And I didn't have any trouble with the narrows above Deer Creek.
People, no trouble there. Okay.
There was. Oh, and then interesting. All the big Boulder. What's that one that's got the? What is that? Boulder Narrows. Not that. I don't think. What's that one called above Deer Creek? That's the big rocks in the center and
Bedrock.
You go. What is it?
Bedrock.
Yeah, Bedrock. Going to Bedrock, the water was over the top of it.
Right, buried.
You know, it was places 11 Mile Rock. Water was over the top of it, and the big center rock below 11 Mile Rock. That the water was over the top of that thing, and the driftwood that had been on top of that my whole life was gone. The driftwood that was stacked up there from ancient time, they were running higher flows presently in '83 than all in the past to put the driftwood up there. So that was interesting. But so we get through Crystal, and we go down to National. Let's see. I'm probably screwing up some of these steps here, because we would have run Crystal and then gone and done that Bass Creek camp across this way there. And then from there, we would have run down finally and camped at National eventually. And then it was lava after that. So do you understand how I'm setting that up?
Yeah.
Okay, so we went to National, which the only place that was dry was up against the entry into the canyon.
Okay.
We went up that far, and that was our camp. And then the next morning, it was down to lava. And we found out that getting to stop, I have stopped on the left side, on the right side, but we stopped on the left-hand side. There was a longer bit of territory to bump your boats and stall the power down along that side, on the left side.
Uh-huh.
And so we tied off there, and then we did the camp at that site. We just hiked up somewhere where it was flat, kind of, and that's where our camp was.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched the rapid, and I had the bright idea to go and set up my sleeping bag at the Lava Falls. Never going to see kind of this kind of water. It was probably at 65,000 or 70 by now. And I go, I'll never, you know, we'll probably never see this again. And so I said, it would be fun to sleep up there. So I brought all my gear up, and went to sleep up there listening to the roar of lava, and it was so frightening. I couldn't even sleep. I had to unpack. I had to drag all my stuff back down to where the boats were moored and everybody else was, and just get it where it was quiet, because the roar of that rapid just was way, way intense. I mean, you can, it just shook you just to listen to it, and you go, God, I got to go through that tomorrow morning. And that was very curious. I've never been by something that was so ferocious. However, looking at it to run it, I didn't think it looked that bad, but just the sound of it was just growling. And but I wised up and got some sleep and went back to camp and did everything there. And so the next morning, we all decided that the best thing is to go down the left side, and there was plenty of water, and I didn't really have too much trepidation about running it. I felt better about that than Crystal, and so we all got pretty close in a line, pushed off, and we all followed each other down through, and we got down through that and lower lava and headed on down. And that pretty much, at this point, other than taking out at Diamond Creek, that was the next thing that our trip went through, was being able to pull into Diamond Creek and not miss it and end up going all the way out to Lake Mead.
Right.
Nobody wanted, you know, we were ready to get off and like go, whoa, that was an experience. You know, it was kind of like time to like sit back and go, shoosh, that was different, you know, and just all, you know, have cheers that we made it and so forth. So getting to stop at Diamond Creek with that much flow and how high up the water was up in the picnic tables and all that kind of stuff. And, but it took just kind of, again, bumping and slowing down against the shoreline, and whoever got in could tie off and help grab any boats that were coming down and make sure they got pulled close and tight to shore, and somebody could take that line and tie it off. And,
okay.
So finally, when all boats were accounted for and ashore, tied off, then it was pretty much party time, and the Ezra van would be coming shortly, and we'd be loading up and passing on our story, and I can't recollect what decisions were made after we got off and told them what we'd been through. Probably the park may have closed it, you know, by the time we got to the back to Ezra and Flagstaff, and probably was just a waiting period where trips were pushed off, canceled, and then when they opened it up, we could go. You may know more about when it closed, the date, and so forth, but I don't recollect when it stopped. But we may have been on the river when it stopped. I don't know.
Right, I have to look it up. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the only thing. Getting out was fine that I recollect, and we didn't have to go all the way to Lake Mead, thank God. Mm-hmm. I don't believe they made us go to, I don't think we went to Pierce's Ferry, which at that period probably wasn't an option. Being in the early days, that was an option. If you missed Diamond Creek, go back and tell the company that we need to get picked up down at Pierce's or wherever. But anyway, we were there and we were going to take out there and pass on to the next group going out what to watch out for. And if they were still running, you know, it can be done. Just there are situations that I can't say exactly where it will happen. But, oh, you know, the thing that I really meant to mention to you before we get off the river now is, and I think I mentioned this earlier, but Jimbo Tishner and Becca Lawton were on this trip we're talking about. They were on it before we gained 5 or 6 or 7 extra guides. They were a part of the crew that I had. I don't recollect the other few people, but
okay.
But we were going down below Redwood Cavern, below there somewhere on... I don't know if it's Conquistador Isle or somewhere's down in that area above Saddle. And that is where, on this water, that is where we've all learned to watch out for eddy fences and eddies. And we came there, and Jimbo was either got caught up in an eddy fence and sucked into the eddy. I wasn't exactly just watching every single person and how they run. I ran it successfully, and it was just a bunch of wild eddy fences and some boils and then the typical calamity that we've seen. But Jimbo was, I think, either got across the eddy fence and stuck in the eddy, and I watched him, and that eddy was swirling around, and that's what made those eddy fences so vicious, is that they weren't just standard eddy fences. They were like, they were swirling with the water flow, hitting it and pushing it and pushing it and grabbing the edge of the eddy and giving it more power to spin and spin. And here Jimbo was out in this thing, and he's getting sucked to the center, which was a big whirlpool. And that whirlpool, I could stand up on my boat and I could see, God, that's a black hole of a whirlpool. I mean, that is seriously a whirlpool. And Jimbo, well, it couldn't get out of all that current and the swirl of that eddy, and it just grabbed him around once, around twice, deeper and deeper into the center. And finally, he was taken into the center of that whirlpool, and he's got a boat that's 18 feet long and X number of 7-plus feet wide with a, you know, some people on it. We've still got passengers, actually, at this point now. I believe that's true. Yeah, that would all have been above Phantom. So, okay. Yeah, so we had all these people, and here Jimbo was about to disappear, and then Jimbo's gone. He's down in the whirlpool. We can't even see him. I can't see his boat or the people now. He's gone down that black hole, of which I thought was just a cartoon feature, you know. But I said, this is really happening. He's gone. He's not like his head's above it all. The boat's halfway up or whatever. It was gone. And so we watched in horror, just going, oh, my God. We've lost that boat in Jimbo. Oh, God, how does it get spit out of the black hole of a whirlpool? What happens to you? I've seen them throw sticks into whirlpools, and they go spun until you don't see them anymore, and they go down to the bottom, and they get flushed out, I guess. But that's what, it was so much water and so much power. That was, as we had gotten down to Phantom to have my new crew and give them heads up, that's where the eddy fences and the whirlpools and the massive eddies were, hey, you got to watch out for this stuff. It'll take you. And so, anyway, that's about it. We got to Diamond.
So what happened to Jimbo and his passengers and his boat? Oh,
I meant to ask him, but I never saw him again. No. He somehow had disappeared, but maybe he got his oars into the walls somewhere. And the walls would have been a few feet tall. And he was able, Jimbo was a tough, savvy, strong guy, mm-hmm. and a lot of experience, and none of us have the experience of being dumped into the center of a whirlpool. So my guess is that when he could get an oar dipped in, he fought his way up and out of it as it was spinning, and somehow got spun out the one available edge that just, you know, God opened the door and let him out.
Okay.
But he was disappeared, you know, for a lot of that time. And I didn't see, you know, people floating downstream or bailing buckets downstream or gear downstream yet.
Okay.
So we just figured, God, he's got to be in. He's still in there. And then all of a sudden, he had climbed up the wall and rowed himself out of the thing and joined us downstream. And so... You know, I wouldn't want that experience myself. And after looking at the boils against walls that were just ugly, it was just like, Jesus, God, you could never swim out of this thing. It would just suck you down and take you to the bottom. It didn't care. And so when things like that happened, you know, you had a lot of, not envy, you had a lot of respect for, don't be an idiot, you know, like these motor rigs hitting the crystal center. There is stuff going on that you've got to be heads up on, or you're not going to make it down. If you're flipped, you're over, and the people are floating, and gear's gone, you're stuck in a rope or something like that, or your life jacket's stuck on a part of the equipment or whatever. I mean, that's it. You're done, and there's too much power. It's like going over Niagara Falls.
Yeah. You know,
nobody survives it. But there weren't that many deaths that I recollect, other than maybe on the motor rigs, might have lost somebody. I think somebody was lost at that Nanquid thing, but I think for as heavy as it was, I don't think that many people drowned.
Okay.
And I was glad. It was a smart move.
I don't think anybody drowned in 1957 when the river popped up to 126,000 or something like that.
Oh, okay.
So, and there were some people that took long swims, and the above Deer Creek, the Granite Narrows down there was doing some pretty wicked things to Georgie's Queen Mary and. But they all survived. So, yeah.
You know, that's what the Granite Narrows, Boulder Narrows, whatever's right there, that is what everybody came off, and it had to do with the water level, because I had heard that, God, it's at the Narrows, it's terrible, and you're going to get slammed up again, and you're going to get pinned, and, oh, it's terrible, on and on. But when we went through, it was a water level change, I guess, and that it was not a thing for us.
The water probably wasn't high enough yet. And it was just a short-lived thing there when the water was high enough to do that in 83.
I think you're right, I believe. I think we were at 70, 75, and it made it, maybe to 90, something like that, I guess.
Yeah.
And that must have made a difference. But having learned from the top to the bottom the amount of respect, it was like, You could do a lot with respect, and using your head and making smart decisions. You could do a lot with that river. I don't know how commercial trips started after we got off the river. I don't remember any of that because the park might have closed it for another part of the season or whatever. But mm-hmm. somebody had to make that decision. It was just too wicked when all these motor rigs were going over and they were getting just destroyed. They were ripped apart, and their boxes were all coming loose, and it was like a garage sale down there. Boats, we'd go back. I remember going back and seeing the Western Ring, I believe. It was the Tour West boat that had flipped. I think they flipped a few of them. But going down when it was okay to go down at smaller levels, maybe 60,000 or 15,000, 60,000, and seeing these rigs tied up against a wall, nothing left on them. They were floating, but everything was just ripped off of them. They were shredded, and these were from their flips somewhere upstream. And that was really weird to be going down and seeing the carnage that hadn't been picked up yet or towed off the river. It's just it was weird. I think as far as we made it to Diamond and off, and eventually, a trip or two later, we started running again, and we were all happy that it was done. And I made, when we got off after probably one more trip, we had a permit for the Middle Fork, and a few of us that were on those trips I'm talking about, we went up to Idaho and did a really nice week and a half long trip up there. But on the way, we went to Glen Canyon Dam and walked into the dam and could feel the shake of the dam. This is after, and you could feel like the vibration, and I wanted to see if the plywood wall was really there. I mean, come on, guys. And there it was, probably inch thick plywood that was somehow bolted into the top of the dam where it was the lake wanted to pour through. I don't remember what they called that particular spot, but
right,
it was
the spillways there. Yeah,
the spill. There's also the ones that went around the whole dam when they built the thing. So that was one way to get rid of the dam water, was that way, as well as just the typical spillways. But there was the channels when they built the dam and ran the river around their construction. That had a wall. I think something started to fail there too in that area with that.
Okay.
That's where the plywood might have come in. You can check that out. But something, I know that they were losing rocks, and they could hear the boulders going down the chutes. So that they were losing a lot of the dam and the wall, that sandstone or whatever they were put the dam in,
right.
It was getting saturated.
Sandstorm's very weak there, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And they could hear, I think the engineers up there and everybody's getting freaked because they could hear something's going on. Something's going down these chutes. And so we wanted to see it. And it wasn't like we wanted to spend a lot of time inside the dam, but we wanted to go and see the generators and get a feel for the whole thing and mm-hmm. see the plywood. Mm-hmm. And then, God, the amount of volume that was being shot out at the base of the dam was like just like the biggest fire hose. You know, just volume shooting out, straight out. I mean, the power to shoot it out, the load that was banked up on top to shoot it out like that was horrific. It was like,
wow,
this is what we were getting downstream, man.
Yeah,
everything
yeah.
the open is open, and it's ferocious. And so that was a good experience after what we'd gone through up in the Colorado to go and look at the dam and how it was functioning and what was really going on that we didn't know about then. And so then we headed off to Idaho and came back and started the season again.
Scott, when was your last commercial season?
87.
Okay. And what?
Yeah, and then my last private trip was 92, I think.
Okay. 1987. What was it that? I think we might have talked about this some. When you decided to say, okay, that I'm going to do something else.
Yeah. Yeah. It was before. I had already made that decision. So I was out in 83. That's when I left. After that season, I decided I was going to take up the opportunity to move to Santa Cruz and take up all the music and all the surfing stuff that I'd really always wanted to do in my life.
Right.
And so...
And you'd already been playing a musical instrument by 1983,
yeah.
right? You were already playing
oh,
on
yeah.
the water. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So I got the saxophone that Jessica of Azra Ownership got me, and I started playing it then in my little trailer in Flagstaff, and
okay.
on, and met other musicians, and played, and that's when I go, you know, I've done, we had talked about my going through the engineering courses at Northern Arizona University that the guy that ran Herman Blybetroy, so I had done that, and now I got my saxophone. And I was playing, and I was still doing the river trips. But that's when I decided I'm going to move to Santa Cruz, and I'm not going to give up my the river stuff. So I let them know that, you know, you can still book me for next year, and the next year, and the next year, and next year. And then it finally got to the point where I said, you know, that's going to be it. I want to make a clean break.
Hmm.
And they did call me back for 87, and I did that. And then I did a private trip in 92. And that was the last time that
okay.
I went down, and I left it at that. I made the break, and I talked to the guides down there, like we talked about with Kent Grua and his other partner that's still down there. I thought of his name the other day. But anyway, they couldn't believe I'd want to leave, and that's kind of other people said, you know, I want to get out of this too, but I just don't see how to do it.
Right.
You know, I don't know how to make that step like you did, you know. I go, well, it wasn't hard for me. It just came to a point where I looked at it and I go, I got to commit. You know, I want to commit. This is what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right? So that was it. And I walked
cool.
away from it. And I didn't completely because I did another 5 seasons or so. And then I did it was a fun private trip, which I'd really never done a private trip down there before. It all been, well, kind of the research trips were like private trips.
What was that like in 92? What was different about that trip? When was it, first of all?
When was it? I think it was in June of 92.
Okay, so midsummer.
Yeah, midsummer, the classic time to run a commercial trip or
okay.
a private trip. And, yeah, it was just pure fun. And I still had a boat that floated, and it was a Havasu. And so I hauled that out, and Pete Wynn had gotten the permit, and it was Pete and I and a slew of other of his friends, my friends, his friends.
Okay.
And we went on down the river at a casual pace, and it was really fun to kind of, like, touch down, you know, with the whole thing again. And as I'm telling you this, going down in 92, it reminds me of my last trip in 97 commercial wise. And I've always said, and I mentioned this, I think, earlier, I had always said that the passengers on the trip, if they don't make the transition from their city life to being actually in Grand Canyon now, if they don't make it by about a week and a half, they'll never make it. And there are the people that make it and the people that don't make it. And you can't change them. They've passed the limit line. And you try and bring them alive, but the ones that get touched by the canyon and an experience, they know it and they buy into it, and they're the ones that really love and believe in what they just went through and did. Mm-hmm. And they are changed, I would imagine, for life, because it's a life-changing thing. And for me, on that, my last commercial trip in 87 was similar to that. I've been away now for a while, and I think the company needed somebody to row a trip, and I said, yeah, I'll come back out. And I was amazed. It was so fun to be back in the canyon and just to kind of have memories of this. Nothing was faded at all, but it was kind of fun just to be down there after I'd been gone for a while. And, you know, to row a boat and be with the passengers and the crew again and mm-hmm. just doing all that. It was really fun. But that's also when I realized how long it was taking me to join in to the spirit of the Grand Canyon again. I did not. It wasn't like, oh, I'm back, you know, nice summer. It was great. Let's do our trips, you know, go on out. No, this was like I was kind of not a greenhorn, but that had left me in a way that you have when you're in the canyon all the time and you don't even recognize the spirits that are around you and working within you. And to go away from it for a while, it wasn't quite like a newborn passenger, but it took a while for me to give in to the whole thing. And the only way that really happened, which this is just my own take on me, but we got to not the Legends camp, but the one below the first, the last chance for Havasu.
Yeah, last
one
chance.
One of those last chances.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Somewhere right around in there. And we partied, and we had pot, and we would smoke. I didn't smoke a lot down there, but it was always fun to get stoned in certain situations in the canyon. It was a real spiritual. I didn't do anything other than pot, but that was plenty to like really touch down. And I didn't feel like an Indian, but it just really, you know, led me into the spirit. And then on top of that, I was on my boat with a bunch of boatmen, and we were drinking some beers as well as that. And I was so excited. All of a sudden, it hit me. I was in the Grand Canyon. All of a sudden, the gown was thrown over me, and I was in the arms of the canyon and the spirits and everything. And you know, the partying just kind of broke down everything. And I can remember jumping off my boat onto the sand or whatever and screaming, you know, something to the effect that, let's party. And I made it to shore, went down on the sand and proceeded to throw up as I wasn't drunk, but everything didn't mix well. Mm-hmm. And I got so sick, and, Becca Lawton was right there, and she cleaned me up and brought me water when I needed it and saved me on the brink of rolling back into the water. It was kind of, it was like one of those breakthrough moments of having been away, and then all of a sudden, all of the spirits, all the ghosts, everything just descended, and I was finally allowed through the door to be a part of the Grand Canyon spirituality. So anyway, that was kind of talking about just how people don't always connect. And when they do, they know it and they're sold. And that was kind of, for me, I had the breakthrough I was there on the road, and it was fun to see these old campsites and what's changed and Deer Creek and everything. All that was the same, but to really be immersed in the solid spirit of magic, that didn't come right away. I had to break down and break into it again, which I was cognizant at that time. And all those, you know, hours and days that it took, I was aware that, you know, I'm not there. You know, I'm not there. And I think I mentioned before, when you're down in the canyon, which helped in that long, difficult hike that Jeff and I had, you become more like an Indian as much as we can. And you respond to the clouds in the sky and the winds changing and all this stuff that an Indian would have in their hearts and in their experiences. And when you're in the canyon all the time, you're really tied in like I wouldn't say I was an Indian, but you're really in touch with things that are happening and what's going to happen, whether you're up a canyon and it's going to flash flood on and on. But the canyon, to work it and live it, it's quite an experience. Lots of things happen, and lots of things you've got to be heads up about. And part of the magic is just being a part of it and letting it show you what it's got, when to defend, when to be safe, good decisions to be made. It's quite a place, you know, to spend that much time down there. It's an honor, opportunity.
Yeah.
So
you bet.
I don't know what else to tell you now. We made it to 83.
Well, we did. I think this is a great place to wrap up this interview series.
Sure.
And I just want to thank you so very, very much for taking the time to recount your life's journey, including so much of Grand Canyon, as you say. Such an honor to be able to be there and do that.
Yeah. And, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this. So thank you so very, very much for doing this.
Yeah. And any time that I need to get a hold of you, or you want to say, oh, you know, I need to fill in this gap, or what do you think about this, and blah, blah, blah. You can always write me or call me or whatever.
That sounds awesome. Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. It was a great deal of fun talking about all this. And again, it just puts me right back in all those moments. So what you're hearing from me is I'm very near those moments that, as I recollect it, and thank God I can recollect, you know, kind of like small things that happened. Some stuff I can't throw it all together, but it's very real that as I told these stories, it was very, very much in that moment. It put me back in that moment. And,
cool.
That's kind of remarkable to go through.
Yeah, fun.
Yeah.
Well, with that,
okay, my friend.
Let's conclude part 11. Of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imslin. Today is Tuesday, June 27th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Scott, thank you so very much.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, and I hope somebody gains a lot of fun or education out of what we've talked about all this time.
Cool. Hang on a second.